I want to welcome you to the Hero Maker Podcast. I'm Dave Ferguson, and I have the privilege of serving as the Exponential Conference President and also as the lead pastor at Community Christian Church in Chicago and lead visionary for the Church Planting Network New Thing. This is the last in our series of six podcasts that are based on the Exponential Conference 2018 theme of Hero Maker. And it's also a book, Hero Maker, The Five Essential Practices of Multiplying Leaders That Multiply that is written by myself and Warren Bird, that comes out in February of 2018. And if for some of you listening in, if this Hero Maker is a new idea for you, you need to think of it this way. Everybody wants to be a hero, but I think few people understand the power of being a hero maker. And a hero maker is somebody who they build the stage and then let somebody else stand on it. The best leaders are not the heroes, but the hero makers. They shine the spotlight on others through whom they accomplish the mission. And today we have with us someone who is a great example of that, Ralph Moore. Ralph and his wife Ruby started Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach, California. And ever since then, they've had a focus on not just growing a church, but multiplying and expanding the kingdom. And we'll get an update from Ralph. But last I heard, the churches that they planted, that planted other churches, are now number more than 2,300. We're going to talk about the fifth practice, which is the of hero making, which is kingdom building. But to back up just a little bit, I just wanted to say welcome, Ralph. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
And I want you to kind of go back a little ways. And did you start off thinking you wanted to plant lots of churches, or is that something that just kind of developed over time?
Well, it actually I kind of came at it from three different angles. As a young person, I grew up in a church that was the biggest in our denomination with 1,300 people. And the denomination, the number four church in size was 200 people. So very, very limited vision of whatever could happen to my life. And so I remember my freshman summer, I was home from college, and I was helping a guy plant a church. A guy named Jerry Cook started a church called East Hill in Gresham, Oregon. It eventually grew to 9,000 people. And they weren't into church planting or church multiplication, but I'd grown up around these pastors of small churches, and I remember thinking, you know, 200 is probably the outside for me. And so I'm thinking about maybe I could start five churches in a series. And each time I would raise up one young guy that would go and follow in my place. And so I was thinking church multiplication when I was about 19 years old. And then a couple of things happened. I got into a Bible college that I struggled. It was like, whatever I'm getting here isn't really lining up with the New Testament. So really out of kind of rebellion, I just decided I'm going to read the book of Acts, the whole thing, at least five times a week for my whole second year of college. And, you know, I begin to much more feel that this isn't lining up with the scripture. You know, we're learning about how to build something big, and there's something else going on here. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it until about 2 years later. I read a book about my own denomination in the Philippines. And they had a church planting movement that got way out of hand. They were having, Jim Montgomery wrote the book, Fire in the Philippines. And they were having 56,000 converts a year with only two missionaries in the country. But the key to that seemed that they lost control of their education process. And it was in the days of, you know, theological education by extension. So it was easy for them to make a cultural shift where they moved away from you have to go to a Bible college to become a pastor, to where somebody who went partway through a Bible college and went back home just naturally started a church. And then some guy he discipled started a church. And that's what really kind of began to coagulate things in my mind. And they came together. And you know, what came out a few years later, kind of we stumbled into planting the first church. And then it was just go from there.
So for you, I mean, it was really, as a young adult, both reading through the book of Acts, but also seeing God do some extraordinary places in a different context that really kind of motivated you to take a different approach to how you were going to lead your church.
Yeah. And it, you know, I was still bound by the church culture that was around me. I mean, that was the primary lens for being a pastor. I remember my wife and I funded this first church out of our own pocket. We had enough money for a down payment for a house, and we started with a dozen people, and 2 months later we were dead broke. We closed the savings account and threw everything in checking and paid the bills, and were able to buy our kids ice cream cones and didn't have enough money for us. And pretty much desperate and trying to just, you know, figure out what ends up. And then the Lord came through in some real wonderful ways financially. But, you know, my perspective there was the day that I ran out of money was the day I failed as a pastor, and my options are go sell used cars or starve. And couldn't really think of bivocational because that was not part of the church culture at the time. I just could only see myself as a failure. The Lord did a couple of miracles 2 days later, and we a bunch of money came running on us from three different places. But then shortly after that, we had a guy that was leading a Sunday night service about 7 miles away from us. We had some people that had a hard time bringing their little kids back to, you know, church in the days of you come to Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. And so we commissioned him to lead a service, and within about 2 months, they decided they wanted to be their own church. And again, my church culture held me back. I told him no. He hadn't gone to a Bible college. He wanted to change the name of the church away from our denominational protocol. And the denomination actually had a rule that you could only have one church in one town, and there was already two there. So I told him no, and then a couple months later, the Navigators recruited him as a missionary to New Zealand. And when that happened, I started to realize if he could do that, he could do this. And so one of my friends had already taught me it's easier to get forgiveness than permission. And so I just went to the denomination, and I hemmed and hawed and fussed around and kept saying, I might have done something wrong. I'm really sorry. Don't know if, you know, I didn't mean to do anything wrong. I did it for about 5 minutes. The guy's begging me to tell him what happened. And this guy was a legalist. And when I finally told him what had happened, all he did was bless us. And so he said it was like wishing my daughter would have children, and can't tell him what to name the children, can't tell her where to have them or when, and you guys just gave birth. So we were, at that point, we were off to the races. And, you know, we began to look for opportunities to plant churches. We were kind of what you would call a level 4 reproductive group at that time. We weren't thinking beyond what churches we could start. We saw ourselves as the center of everything. It was only after I moved to Hawaii that we realized that our vision was bigger than level 4 and that we had to step to level 5 where we were planting churches that would plant other churches that plant other churches.
Well, let me jump in there. So for anybody who might be new to Exponential, when Ralph refers to a level 4, we talk about 5 different levels of churches. Level 1 would be those churches that are in decline. Level 2 would be those churches that are plateaued. And in the North American context, that makes up about 80% of all churches at level 1 and level 2. Level 3 churches would be those churches that are growing, which makes up about 16% of the churches. And then you have what we call level 4 and level 5. Level 4 would be reproducing churches, churches that have ever started a brand new site, campus, or a brand new church. And that's about 4% of all the churches, which leaves you level 5, which are those churches that are multiplying or rapidly multiplying. And we probably have a couple examples of those in the North American setting. And we're blessed to have Ralph with us, who is one of the few examples that we're all aspiring to kind of follow in his footsteps.
Dave?
Level 5. So Ralph, you planted that first church, and if we fast forward, you can kind of update us on how many you have planted now, but fill in some of the gaps in between from that first church you planted there kind of reluctantly, and some of the things that happened between then and where things are today.
Well, two or three things are really key to that. One is it's kind of, you know, I know that I got a chance to look at your manuscript for Hero Maker, and one of the issues is permission giving and then commissioning somebody. And one day we were sitting around talking. We had an opportunity. Somebody had offered us a church building. And, I mean, a lot of money in Southern California for real estate. So this was a big deal. And one of our guys he was just a gifted evangelist. He was a kid in high school leading his friends to the Lord, Jewish kid. And they had started a Bible study on Friday night in the home of another kid. Actually, the home was the place where O.J. Simpson lived when all that tragedy happened. Simpsons had bought it from these people. But this thing grew to about 45 people every Friday night and was going strong. And suddenly David Cohen came to me and said, I can't do this any longer. I'm not a pastor. I'm an evangelist. And so we're frustrated. We got a group of people with no leader. We got a building being offered to us. And we bought an old house that we could use the garage for a Sunday school because we were growing real fast. And we're sitting there and this guy, Gary Sinardi, comes walking by the window. And we yelled at him, Gary, come on in here, come on in. And he comes in, and so I go, say yes. And he goes, what? And I go, say yes, just say yes. And everybody in the room started chiming in, about five of us, say yes. So he goes, yes. So what did I say yes to? And I go, you're going to be the pastor of Hope Chapel in Culver City, California. And actually, they changed the name of it on the way, but he started and took over the little group, moved them, and it went really, really well, which kind of gave us an attitude that this is really the Holy Spirit's business to make things happen. It's our business to identify potential and then bless that potential. And, you know, pretty flippant way for a guy to get called into a pastorate. But Gary's gone to heaven, but he's had several very successful ventures in ministry ever since then.
And when I don't know what the, and I think just it'll be important for our audience to know. I know you're always reluctant to kind of talk about this, but so how many church plants have now come out of that original church plant?
Well, actually, we believe, and we never really know because we've tried to stay a movement and not an organization and or a denomination. So we really have no way of reporting back other than about every 3 or 4 years. I'll go and email everybody or have somebody in the office email or phone people. And I mean, it gets to be way out of hand because the last count was 2,317. And I did that because Exponential was asking me questions. And then shortly after that, some of the guys who never answered my email came in with, how come you never included me? And it's like, well, because you never answered. But that put it over 2,400. And then we have a guy in Japan who's doing wonders in India. So we're well over 2,400 churches that we know of. And we're pretty sure there's quite a few that we don't know of.
That's awesome. And I'll tell you what, and we've talked about this a little bit before, but I'd love for you to speak to the audience that's listening today that, I mean, on the one hand, I mean, you are a great example, I think, of a hero maker and what we're talking about, a level 5 church. But I know we've also, and you've written about this too, where personally you've had times you struggle with panic attacks or anxiety and even some self-esteem issues. Talk to that church plan that's listening in going like, wow, I love that Ralph's done that, but I could never, ever do what he's done.
Well, you know, first, I've had anxiety issues. I really, really do have an ongoing problem. I have to take medication. It kind of blew out. My wife had cancer about 15 years ago, and there were several other things going on in my life, and I had a real severe deal. But the low self-esteem thing, I don't really buy into that. I think I'm right and everybody else is wrong. That's why I left the denomination I was in. And that's what I like about Exponential is I think you guys are right. And so, I came from a place of limited vision. I came up as a Pentecostal at a time when that wasn't popular. I came from a Bible college rather than a seminary. So, you know, all the things that the Christian world would look at you and kind of put a black mark by your name, you know, those are mine. But to me, the biggest thing that I've ever done is to always think in terms of three numbers, 3, 12, and 120, and then a fourth, it's really not a number, but a concept, and that's world domination through love. Jesus had Peter, James, and John. There were the 12, and I think that you could make a case, not a very strong one, but you could make a case for Peter, James, and John might have had 3 each. And then he left behind a church in Jerusalem, and I see Jesus as the person who planted the church at Jerusalem that we read about in Acts chapter 1. 120 people. So if I'm thinking that, I go to a pastor's conference and I go, you know, you're pastoring 60 people here. Could you get it to 120 in a lifetime? Would you pray for that? And they go, yes. On the other hand, I'm looking at guys who are pastoring 4,000 people and go, to whom much is given, much is required. If you got more than 120, it's time to start dancing. And then ultimately, the whole thing comes down to the Great Commission that we're thinking. I mean, the Great Commission really demands that we think of dominating the world, not through politics or through forcing morality on people, but through the love of Jesus and the gospel. So to me, the answer to your question, the real answer, comes down to, I like to do in conferences, I ask people, just take a piece of paper, get your pen ready, and don't think. I'm going to tell you what to do. I'm going to count to three. And then I tell them, I want you to write the name of your three closest disciples. And I'll watch people in the room. If there's 200 people in the room, there'll be about 15 that immediately start writing. And then maybe another 60 that, you know, they pause for a little bit and they write a name, then they pause and write another name. And then the rest of them don't have any names to write at all. And so, you know, the challenge is, if you don't have a list, you better build one. And if you do have a list, you better assess, are these productive people or am I wasting my time trying to disciple people who are not going to go anywhere? And, you know, that's a pretty simple thing. If you're listening to this and you're going, how could I ever do this? Well, I've only ever discipled anybody in very small groups. I started out one at a time, still do that. But a big group to me would be a dozen people. And I just want to spend as much time as I can with them and get to know them in terms of their personal life as well as their ministry life. And, you know, just a lot of it's just hanging out.
I love that because, I mean, that's something that almost, I would say, that's something everybody who's listening, everybody can do that.
Yeah. Doesn't take a dime other than what you spend at Starbucks.
There you go. I think, Ralph, you were kind enough to take a look at the manuscript from the Hero Maker book, and I'd love to for us to go through kind of the five practices and just maybe quickly kind of get your take on these five practices of a hero maker. The first practice that we talk about is multiplication thinking. When and how did you start thinking like that yourself?
Well, it kind of goes back to that first story I told where I was on the lawn of the East Hill Church in Gresham, Oregon. We started with like 24 people, I think, and it was 27 people. And I was there just for a summer. And, you know, 12 weeks later, we'd grown to the massive size. Now, remember our denomination, the fourth largest church was 200. And we had grown from 27 to 72. And it's like, wow, this is something really, really happening. But I was constrained by where I fit in this larger scheme of my church family. And so I my only option was to think of multiplying myself and through that multiplying the kingdom. My what triggered all was I was humming a song. There's an old hymn that we used to sing called "Oh for a Thousand Tongues to Sing My Great Redeemer's Praise." And it caused me to think, I wonder if in my lifetime, 1,000 people would come to know Jesus because I lived. And then that's where I came up with the idea of 5 to 7 churches that I would, you know, plant and hand off. It was pretty small beginnings for me.
Well, I'll tell you what, if everybody can begin, just dare to begin to think a little bit that way too. It's amazing what God can do with that. The second practice we talk about is mission giving. I would love for you to share with us a little bit, who were some of the people that believed in you along the way?
I've been thinking about this quite a bit. The person who stands out in my mind the most is a woman named Eloise Clarno. I was a little kid at a youth camp, maybe 6th grade, 11 years old, and I was praying. We had down in the front, we prayed at an altar or something, and basically I was just sitting there feeling bad because I was homesick, and this lady who I thought was more of a friend of my mother's than she was, they were acquaintances, came up and put her arm around me. I still remember she was wearing a white dress with red and orange and blue balloons on it. And this was like, had to be 1955. And I can still picture that dress. And she kind of stuck on me the rest of my life and would always believe in me, challenge my thinking. She was really good at going after me. And that was a good thing. And then I was with Jack Hayford when I was in the Bible college, and I became student body president. And I remember he and I used to argue quite a bit, and I kind of enjoyed that. Jack and I argued all of our lives, but at one time we had an event that just blew out sideways. The people that prepared the food were really late. People were starting to get angry. Hayford stood up and defended me in a real strong way, and then pushed me out behind a curtain and made me go out and talk to everybody. And it was like kind of a defining moment of, hey, I am a leader and I need to act like one. And then the third element in all that, and this is one that I usually talk about because everybody knows the name, and it usually causes a little controversy, which I kind of like, but it's Robert Schuller. I went to his first ever pastor's conference. I think it grew to like 8,000 people. When I was there was like 120. We were 20 people into a new church and about 3 weeks into that. So I was the youngest guy, the newest into a church. And Bob and Arvella just took my wife and I under their wing. And I'd go down and meet with them occasionally. And then he sent a guy named Wilbert Eichenberger. And Eichenberger drove a yellow Mercedes. He was a wealthy guy that, you know, they just raised up as a leader in their church. And he left his business to serve in the church. And he'd come up once a month and take me to some lunch where I couldn't afford the restaurant, and then scold me about, you know, you need a bigger building, you're outgrowing this thing. And they were level three thinkers. They were into addition. But when we began to multiply, they really got behind that. And then Schuller would ask me to come back and speak at his conference every year. I did that for like 10 or 11 years. And then, you know, late in his life, he invited me back again, told me he was angry at me because he kept seeing Hope Chapel here and Hope Chapel there, and he thought I was moving all over the country. And Bob always believed in long pastorates. And then his daughter joined one of our churches in Maui, and he got the picture. And so that's when he invited me back. But even then, it was like I went there to speak, but I had a 45-minute time with Bob alone, and then they invited me to lunch after. And so it was just that going out of your way to spend time with somebody and let them know that you believe in them that made a huge difference in my life.
Those are such great examples. I mean, if someone's listening, and I mean, maybe, you know, you're working with students at a youth camp. I mean, look at how profound the impact your words can make. Or if you happen to be the pastor of a very large church, the same kind of thing. I mean, because there were different people that God used along the way to really kind of give you permission to do what you've been able to do. Talk about the third practice of disciple making. I'm going to put you on the spot. Who are you discipling right now?
I'm discipling Michael Kai and Michael Chung and Xavier Koide. One's Chinese American, one's Japanese American. I'm discipling two different groups of what we call mini church leaders, guys that are leading home groups. And then I have a Saturday group of about seven guys, who are all doing different things in ministry, and they just don't fit in any category. And I hang out with them. I'm meeting with my successor to be, because I'm retiring from the church in November. And then I'm working with another guy who's really going to end up being the spokesperson for our movement. I mean, he kind of gets it better than anybody else. Had lunch with him yesterday. And then I got two other guys in Japan, because that's kind of been our secondary project always after Hawaii. Fumichito and Sugiyoshi Suzuki, who goes by Paul, and they're multiplying churches in Japan. Actually, Suzuki is, and Chito is, it's a mega church by Japan standards. He's just now 11 years in, getting ready to launch the first church. In fact, I'm paying his way to come to Exponential West in a month or so. So these are my guys, and this is my life. This is more important to me than church administration. The only other thing that's important to me is that I prepare good enough sermons and Bible that is teaching oriented so that people can minister to each other around the scripture in the home groups, the mini churches that we do.
I think what we just heard there is really important for everybody listening in, because I think a lot of people now are saying, yeah, I want to develop a church that has a reproducing culture or a multiplying culture, level 4, level 5 church. But the thing that I think so many of us miss is that in order to create a culture, as the leader, you have to be doing it. And I knew that if I asked you that question, you'd give me a handful of names, and that's what I wanted our listeners to hear. Because I think part of the reason that you've been successful isn't so much about strategy and tactics and those kind of things, but ultimately, as leaders, we reproduce who we are. And anyway, thanks for that. I want to move to the fourth practice of gift activating. When we talk about gift activating, one of the things we encourage in hero making is the idea of commissioning somebody. Did you have anybody who ever kind of commissioned you and gave you your blessing when you were first starting out?
Yeah, I got kind of two stories. One guy was named Art Miller, and I worked for him as a youth pastor. He had tried to recruit my best friend to come and work in his church. He had moved from Oregon, where we knew him, where I grew up, to Southern California, took over a church of about 150 people that had shrunk to in the 20s because of a Lockheed Aircraft layoff. Everybody, you know, left the San Fernando Valley and the church shrunk, and he became the pastor. And he actually asked me to drive his car to California, which was my free ride to go to college. And I brought along my best friend, who was a year ahead of me in the same college, and he was kind of a superstar guy. And so Art tried to recruit him, and he didn't want to come. So I volunteered, kind of wondering, you know, I wasn't the other guy. And instantly he took me up on it and would drive twice on Sundays, 45 miles each way, so like 180 miles, to pick up me and my friends to go to church, and then eventually hired me as a youth pastor. And so I really, you know, got a blessing from him. And then later on, I've always kind of lived in contention with my denomination, because they're really into what you guys call level three. And it's always been a struggle. And you know, I pretty quickly got involved in their leadership circles. And I was always the fly in the ointment. I was always the guy bothering them about that we need to plant churches. And they're always talking about it, but not much happens. And then we got in some pretty open conflict at one point, and I wasn't ready to back down. And the president of the denomination, who was considered to be kind of a crotchety old line thinker, who was too conservative by everybody else. And this is like during the Jesus movement. And a lot of tension going on between the churches trying to be big and then groups like us. And he stood up for me. And that made a big, huge difference. And I never really... You know, I think I wrote him a letter once, but I never really got to honestly thank him for what he did. It meant a lot to me that he was the guy that everybody else saw as too conservative, and they saw us as too radical, but he was the guy who backed us. And pretty much his generation backed us. They had seen the Pentecostal revivals and the church planting that went on out of that. They were old enough. And so when they saw what we were doing, they liked it. And that was very, very important to me, just that they liked it.
The one of the things I wanted to land on, because especially having you here, I think in becoming a hero maker, the kingdom building part, what you actually count, kind of the scoreboard aspect of this, how do you keep score these days? I mean, what ultimately counts, if there are two or three metrics that are essential to being a hero maker?
Yeah, I think the number of people in our discipleship groups, because that's the number of people that we'd really consider church members, the rest are spectators. They're learning to minister to one another. We're raising them up to replace the leader in the group, because that's how we do it. We hive off and take the leader out. And so he's always, you know, multiplying. And we're always looking for, you know, if you end up starting three churches that way, we think that you could become a church planter. And our deal there is if you work for the church, then we'll fund you, because we took you out of industry. You don't have a job, and we don't want to shortchange you. But if you have a career, then we want you to be bivocational. And if you want to grow beyond that and, you know, end up full time, that's fine. But that's not a qualifier for us. So the number of people in these groups is a big deal. And then just to me, the you know, Jesus said to pray for the Lord of the harvest to send laborers into the harvest. If I don't see people being raised up to plant churches, I start getting nervous. And so I'm always looking at the number of churches that we're planting, not necessarily the number as a movement, because I've tried to not have control, and because I don't think you can be a movement if you want to have control. I think, you know, there's a book I promote real heavily, The Starfish and the Spider. If you want to be a spider, you cut one leg off a spider, it'll live. You cut two legs off, it can't feed itself. You cut a leg off a starfish, you get two starfish. Some starfish you cut all the legs off, or cut it into 200 little pieces, you're going to get 200 starfish. And so we've looked at the church in China. Right now we're involved in a place called Wenzhou, and it's the Jerusalem of China. It's where most of the house church thing got started, you know, way back in the 40s. And the government is coming down. There's some underground churches that number over 4,000 people. They got big buildings and whatever. And the government is doing their best to close those churches. And it's like the worst thing that could happen for the Communist Party and the best thing that could happen for the church is that they're going to lose control. As soon as you close a church of 4,000, you're going to get 300 churches. And the government loses control. And then the Holy Spirit gains control. So we've always tried to think about those things. In my own life, you know, I'm stepping down. I pastored a church for 12 years that grew to about 2,200 people, 2,300 maybe, in attendance. Then I came to Hawaii, and I was for 29 years in a church that grew to about the same size. And we handed off, and then we planted a church. I was 60-something years old. And we're running about 300 people right now, and we've started 8 churches. So we're pretty happy with that. But when I retire, I'm going to move to California, and I'm hoping to be able to start a church in the gay community. I'm really frustrated with the fact that rather than trying to evangelize people, we're doing our best to alienate them. And so I'm looking forward to, you know, I mean, it's down to where I'm just decided to make it a policy. I'm not going to ever do a wedding again because I want to stay away from that controversy. But I just want to evangelize people and then let the Holy Spirit police them. And so, you know, I just want to make sure that I'm building the kingdom, that our church is building the kingdom. And then hopefully my deal is that I'm making heroes out of people, telling a lot of stories and keeping the vision alive.
I love that. That's awesome. One of the things we've been kind of challenging people with too, is they talk about, well, you know, it's really kind of hard. How do I keep track of all that? And I said, you know, and kind of using exactly what you're said. I mean, the goal is to actually continue to multiply to a place where you actually can't keep track of it. And if you can get to that place, that's actually good news. Ralph, I'll tell you what, this has been really, really good. Thank you so much for the time. I would love for you just take a minute to wrap up, because I mean, so many of us in the exponential family, and then others that are listening in would love to do what you've done. Take a few moments just to challenge us as church leaders and church planters. What's kind of on your heart that you'd like to kind of challenge us with?
Well, the first thing is name your 3 closest disciples, because if it doesn't start there, it won't go anywhere. And, you know, the things we talked about earlier just kind of issue forth from that. Second would be to keep your eye on the Great Commission, because that's keeping your eye on the ball. I was rereading a book by Chuck Swindoll about mediocrity. And if you look at the church, he uses the word excellence in there. And I think we've mistaken perfection and performance for excellence. And that's a mediocre goal. You know, I can build a church of 30,000 people that is flawless in performance, and I didn't do much more than a Las Vegas show would do. Or I can look for the Great Commission, and I can really swing for the fences, and that's what I see as excellence. And, you know, I got into a conversation this morning with a guy over video production in our own church, and he's all for, you know, upping the ante and making, you know, pushing for perfection. At the same time, the tension is I'm all for getting people with GoPros and the phone in their cell camera to make videos that we use for promoting events in our church. And And so I'm looking for lower quality events or lower quality videos and higher quality leaders to come out of that thing. And so I think that's a huge issue. And then the third thing that I would say there is that we should not be thinking in terms of networks. Is the fear that I have while all this is going on right now, and there is a really healthy focus on making disciples and multiplying churches, is that guys will start with networks and rather than getting into movements. And I see that as a control issue. If you're thinking you could start 12 churches or you could start 20 churches, you're probably thinking way too small. You should be thinking I could start a couple hundred churches over a lifetime of ministry, and from there we could start several thousand churches. But you're going to have to let go of control, because otherwise you'll just be limited to the network where you can brand everything. Most of our churches don't use the name Hope Chapel. I think 3 or 4 generations out, the day I die, they won't even hear about it. And to me, that's a great victory.
Ralph, you are a refreshing leader and a real encouragement to all of us. So I want to say, thanks for spending time with us. Thanks for all that you've done and all that you are doing. And for those of you who are listening in, just want to remind you about the Exponential Conference 2018. It's coming up on it's February 29th through March 1st of 2018. You can find out more about that at exponential.org. Just go to exponential.org to register and learn more about that. And if you'd like to pre-order the new book by myself and Warren Bird titled Hero Maker, you can, of course, go to Amazon or christianbooks.com or Barnes & Noble to pre-order that now. And just say thank you so much for listening.